Hi everyone, Dr. Goyal here from Peak Human Labs, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Momchilo Vujicic, who's the founding chief science officer at Viom and also head of clinical research. And in this interview with him, we talk in great depth about what's happening at Viom and how they're basically using our understanding of the microbiome and RNA expression to really give customized, precision-based recommendations that improve your health. So stay tuned, enjoy, and I'll see you on the other side.
Doing amazing. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining me today. Where are you located? Where are you at right now?
I'm in Seattle, in sunny Seattle.
You're very lucky. We're here in Toronto, so it's already getting winter here, coming here. I reached out to Viome because I was really excited when I saw a talk by Naveen Jain, who's being interviewed by Peter Diamandis. I thought, this is some pretty groundbreaking technology happening here. I mean, I think our viewers and myself are quite familiar about the whole value of the microbiome, but it looks like what's happening at Viome is a whole step above that, like general microbiome testing. Is that how you would?
I would like to say yes.
So maybe before we get into that, can you take me a little bit through your kind of how you got into this whole space, like into this whole field, like a little bit of your background?
Of course.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, like many people, I had my own health journey. So as a graduate student many, many years ago, I developed an autoimmune condition.
Okay.
And no one knew what it was.
Yes.
A whole bunch of symptoms, and the doctors just simply said, this is autoimmune, we just need to hit it and pour some water on the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Without actually understanding what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, even after a few years, it just got progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take any pharmaceuticals or anything, but I was managing it with NSAIDs. And it was getting progressively worse. And based on my chemistry background, I have a PhD in chemistry, and based on my extracurricular reading about the human body and microbial physiology and evolution and, you know, lots of dots connected together, I basically knew that this was not genetic, and this autoimmune never showed up in any of my family history.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it wasn't genetic. I knew it was environmental, and I thought, you know, the food most likely had a role in it. So unfortunately, I went through the frustrating several years of trying different fad diets, and I see that's still commonly done by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried many different diets, and you know, there's a story behind every one of those, you know, but ultimately, I tried the ketogenic diet, and that diet in about 3 months almost wiped out my memory. It really affected me in a very negative way. And later on, I figured out why that was. But at that time, you know, it was just a fad that people were promoting, that, you know, everyone should be on that. And I was desperate enough and tried it. And so after that, I basically quit dieting, and I just kept doing research and research and research. And so one thing that caught my attention was this particular antigen that's found in mammalian food products.
Mm-hmm.
It's called NEU5GC, so it's spelled NEU5GC, and it's a small molecule that all mammals produce, and
mm-hmm.
humans used to produce millions mm-hmm. of years ago, but
right.
we actually stopped producing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, all humans on the planet are incapable of producing this molecule, but all mammals
mm-hmm.
Produce it. So when we ingest it, our immune system can react to it.
Right.
And long story short, that's exactly what turned out to be the case once I stopped eating all mammalian food products. So that means all red meats and all dairy. Slowly but surely, my symptoms went away. It took about a year to heal.
Oh,
but
wow.
I basically completely cured myself. And this was, you know, not to, you know, make this podcast about my autoimmune, but I mean, it was a completely consuming sort of a condition from the moment my eyes opened until I fell asleep. 7 days a week, every second of my thoughts, of my activities, of my planning were consumed by this disease. So it was quite serious.
How common is that? I'm just so curious. It's NEU5. What's NEU5?
NEU5GC.
GC.
Yeah, so that's sialic acid. So how common is it? Well, we don't know. And it's very challenging to measure this molecule, and there's a, you know, there's a deeper story behind that.
Right.
But people can certainly read, Dr. Ajit Varki at UC San Diego is a pioneer in this space, and I'm very grateful to him. I actually went and met him and described this to him, and he said, well, yeah, I mean, I've heard this story from many other people. So I, you know, he thinks it's common, I think it's common. I just think that most people don't think about what it could be the root cause, and are lucky enough to have the scientific background and read the right papers and find this out. I mean, this is, this took years to find out, you know, reading highly technical papers on molecular biology and physiology and genetics and all kinds of comparative studies. I mean, this is not easy.
Right.
So that, that was a big contributor to what I'm doing today. Another big contributor is that I was very disenchanted by the academic life. I was an academic, and you know, I was just disenchanted with let's publish papers, then submit more grants, then publish more papers, then submit more grants. I just wanted, I wanted to do something that had an impact on humanity, and I just didn't feel like it was, it was, you know, academic life was for me. Basically, that led me to this sort of, hey, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to change the world. And so a combination of several factors basically led me to plan out what we call today Nutrition 2.0, which is a true scientific platform for choosing exactly which foods a person should eat and in what amounts in order to tune their physiology. And I knew that there was a solution. So it's not like I blindly went after some magic or, you know, bad, you know, good luck or anything like that. I knew there was a solution because I had studied the diets in the blue zones. And you have many, many examples of humans who are 95. They actually sheep herd all day long. They climb mountains. They have no health problems of any kind. They have never seen a doctor. They have never taken a pharmaceutical. They have never taken an antibiotic. They have never gone to a grocery store. So the solution to this problem, nature has already figured out. And there are, you know, tens of thousands of examples of this naturally occurring. All we have to do is learn how do we tune every person's body, because everyone is different today. And that's a whole nother story. I think that those people in blue zones, they're actually not very different from each other. I think that they live in sync with nature so closely that they all basically recycle that environment internally and externally, and they are in tune with their diet, and that's just all tuned. But today, in modern world, of course, we have antibiotics, we have food preservatives, we have sterile life, we have sterile food, we have processed foods. We have all kinds of environmental impacts like pesticides, and you know, it's a long story, but our microbiomes are different. If we pick two random people, their gut microbiomes are very different. They're essentially completely different. And so, because of that, we have to eat different foods. And so, in 2010, I basically completely changed my scientific career. I dropped everything that I'd been doing, and I focused on two things. One is developing the technology needed to understand the human body like it's never been understood before. And second, focusing on the gut microbiome at that time. And so, in, you know, up to that 2010, you know, in my mind, I was brainwashed basically by all the geneticists that were propagating this you know, false truth that genetics is the key to all chronic diseases, and that once we sequence the human genome, we will unlock all its mysteries, and we will have a healthy population. Well, not only did that not happen, but today the disease burden is higher than it was when we sequenced the human genome. And now, you know, 10 years ago I had to sort of preach this, but now there are very solid publications demonstrating that human genetics plays a minor role in chronic diseases. And that was shown very nicely in very large twin studies where you take genetically identical twins, and one of them develops a chronic disease and the other one doesn't. And then they looked at and found out that it's the gut microbiome, nutrition, and lifestyle that are really causing these diseases and not really the genetics. Genetics plays a role. I don't want to say that genetics plays no role. Of course, it's a part of it. But in 2010, I basically came to it culminated in my connecting the dots and realizing that we need to study the human body where we study the interactions between the nutrition, the oral microbiome, gut microbiome, and human cells and human metabolism, including the human immune system, and that we have to not study the genetics, because the genetics is the potential at birth, but that doesn't mean anything when you're 50, or doesn't mean much. I knew that we needed a better technology than genetics, and so I wanted to develop this new technology that we're using now at Viome called metatranscriptomics.
Right.
And we can spend more time on that if you'd like, but basically the short story is the next 6 years, I built very large programs at Los Alamos National Laboratory, recruited very, very smart people on my team, 35 scientists, and we developed the underlying technology that we're using today at Viome, mm-hmm. and then we patented all that, and then I jumped ship basically and started Viome with Naveen Jain, and then we continued the development. You can only do so much at a national lab. You cannot really translate that knowledge and offer a product and so on. So we've done, we did 6 years of development at the Los Alamos National Lab for the foundation, but then we've just mm-hmm. taken that to, many orders of magnitude above that here at Viome in the last 7 years. So it's mm-hmm. been a 13-year journey, and I'm just super excited because, for 13 years, we've had to sort of convince people that this is the next thing, this is the revolution. Mm-hmm. But the simple question, does it work? Mm-hmm. We've had to say, give us some time. And finally, this year, we've had some really breakthrough results in clinical trials.
I think I saw that on your paper on the mood and the depression. What's the second thing you had showed a big improvement
well,
on?
Well, so we use clinically validated surveys for depression, anxiety, and IBS.
Yeah.
And then we use a clinically validated molecular survey, molecular score, essentially, for type 2 diabetes or HbA1c.
Right.
We use those surveys and scores as endpoints, and we showed statistically significant improvement in all of these mood disorders and well-being and glucose control and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has now been published, but even more exciting is the fact that we are running several randomized controlled trials, and one of them just became successful like a month ago, and I'm actually, as of this morning, starting to write a publication to submit to JAMA, where you take a population of people that mm-hmm. have elevated HbA1c, and you either give them the Viome nutrition or placebo, and the Viome nutrition improves the reduces the HbA1c statistically significantly over the placebo. That's very important. Very important in there as well is that 100% of the intervention that people experienced, you can buy at a Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, right? There is no secret ingredient. You don't have to go to a specialty store. There are no pharmaceuticals. It's just every person on the trial received a different diet, and that was all 100% data driven. So the title of the paper will start with data driven, because it is truly data driven. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that the data from a person drives the choice of foods that person needs to eat. And mm-hmm. without that data, you cannot tell, you should eat ketogenic or you should eat Mediterranean or any of that. That's just guesswork.
Mm. Okay, so let's just on this study, let's just a couple more points on that. So how much difference was there in the A1C? Like what type of change?
It was 0.42%.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So, but note that this particular trial focused on pre-diabetics. Mm. So the starting HbA1C was around 6.
Yeah.
So these were not diabetics.
Yeah.
We actually have 3 trials running where we have insulin resistance people, pre-diabetics, and diabetics. And so the pre-diabetic trial already shows statistically significant improvement.
Mm-hmm.
The diabetics and the diabetic trial, we haven't done any interim analysis, so we're just moving that forward. The insulin sensitivity one, where fasting glucose is the primary endpoint, it's actually showing a very solid trend,
mm-hmm.
but we haven't reached statistical significance, so mm-hmm. we're keep moving. But we want, really, our ultimate goal at Viome is to identify the very earliest signs of disease that you wouldn't notice because there are no symptoms, but we can see it at the molecular level. So for example, if you test someone and they have HOMA-IR that's elevated, whether it's fasting insulin or fasting glucose, that they're on their way to become diabetics eventually.
Sure.
If they don't change something. And so can we make those changes early on before diabetes settles in? Because presumably the later the stages of the disease, the harder it's gonna be to treat, plus there's going to be downstream effects of that disease. We all know diabetes has a lot of downstream bad effects. So
mm-hmm.
really, when it comes to all these diseases, for example, when it comes to any inflammatory disease in the gut like IBD, we would really like to understand, this person has molecular inflammation in the gut. Let's reverse that back to healthy. When a person has mild cognitive impairment, let's revert that back to healthy instead of, going downhill to dementia. And so on. So really, ultimately, what I would like as a takeaway to be is the revolution that we started is a revolution where we treat the human body like we've treated airliners for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
The example I like to give is that we have this Airbus A380. I don't know how many people are familiar, but it's the most complex airplane ever built in history of mankind, right?
Okay.
And that plane has never had a crash, okay? And the reason it's never had a crash is because we understand that airplane very well. We have put sensors in that plane at tens of thousands of places where something could fail, and we're measuring things before they fail. So you don't see the rudder of that plane failing and the plane losing control and crashing because they have sensors in the rudder actuation systems that tell you, hey, this part is getting worn, it needs to be replaced.
Sure.
And so there's preventative maintenance. Why can't we have that for the human body? All we have to do is digitize it with relevant data. And keyword here is relevant. Genetics, unfortunately, is not relevant. So when you do your test and it says you have a 9% higher chance of developing IBD, there's really nothing about that you can do. There's no action. There's like, okay, that sucks, but what do I do about it? And if you already have IBD and they tell you, well, you were genetically predisposed, what are you just gonna say, well, I give up, there's nothing I can do, I'm just gonna live with it? No, there are so many environmental influences that you can control that you should actually try to do something about it, but you have to have the data.
So you're testing, though, just for our viewers, only taking a stool sample. So you're looking at the microbiome and gene expression, or are you looking at some other molecules?
Let me explain. So we do have the ability to test only stool, but that's not really the whole picture. Like I said, you have to look at the whole body. And so our flagship product is stool, blood, and saliva.
Okay.
And the reason for that is saliva, turns out, is a very important site where oral microbiome interacts via gums with our immune system and can actually translocate into the bloodstream. And so again, 10 years ago, I had to sort of preach the importance of oral microbiome, but today there are many publications in the peer-reviewed literature showing the mechanistically that oral bacteria can translocate, if someone has gum disease, into the blood. And if they have systemic inflammation where the blood-brain barrier is weakened, those bacteria can actually make their way to the brain. And this is likely the cause of Alzheimer's, because amyloid beta is just a response to our body to the microbial presence. But
right.
Those microbes didn't go there because you were perfectly healthy. You had all these conditions that are kind of asymptomatic. And so if you look at epidemiology, gum disease is one of the highest risk factors for Alzheimer's, and that's now confirmed mechanistically. So you have to look at where are the microorganisms, where are they interacting with our immune system and our bloodstream, and that's in the gums and the intestinal lining. We eventually, of course, want to go to the blood-brain barrier and study it, and we have trials set up to run, but we haven't found partners for that yet, so we would love to do that. But if you look at a complex disease like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or type 2 diabetes, there are faults at multiple sites. It's not like an infectious disease where you get one bug and you're sick. It's multifactorial. And so yes, so we would like all of our customers, and certainly for our clinical research participants, we not only have stool, blood, and saliva, but we collect typically urine and vaginal swabs, and then for some studies we collect additional samples like throat swabs or nasal swabs or skin and so on. So from these three samples, what we do is we do exactly the same analysis no matter what the sample is. We want to understand what microbes are present there and in what amounts, first of all. And not the most important thing, but it is important. The second thing is we want to find out what genes they're expressing. And then if there are human cells, what genes are expressed in those human cells? And so obviously in blood, we have mostly human cells, so we are gonna focus on gene expression. However, there are actually human cells in poop, in stool, because there's shedding, there's vast amounts, there's like billions of human cells that are being shed in stool every day. And what the expression profile of those cells can tell you quite a bit about health. For example, we can very clearly distinguish people with IBD and people who are healthy at actually multiple levels. So we don't ignore human cells and human transcripts. And in saliva, we actually have quite a good ratio of human cells and microbial cells. And both of those are informative about the health of the gums and oral health.
How do you assess the gene expression? I mean, just from basic biology, if you could explain to
me. Let's talk about what gene expression is. I think that's a fundamental concept. So the examples I like to give is, We all have in our genome six genes that encode alcohol dehydrogenase. So that's a gene that protects us from ethanol or alcohol, right?
Got it.
But right now, I have no alcohol in my system, so none of those genes are expressed, meaning they're just dead pieces of DNA floating in my cells. And
yeah.
In fact, all of my cells, every single cell, even neurons, have that gene, okay? Those six genes.
Got it.
Now, as soon as I consume alcohol, the liver cells, and only the liver cells, sense that there's alcohol, which is a toxin, and they will then express those six genes. What that means is that enzymes, or little nanomolecular machines, will copy DNA and make RNA, and that's what we study. And then that RNA will get translated into proteins, and
yeah.
These proteins are enzymes that degrade ethanol. So
right.
They're the functional elements of the gene. So if someone, for example, has very low gene expression due to alcohol, that means that alcohol is going to have more negative effects on them, right? If someone has a robust gene expression, and unfortunately alcoholics have a very robust gene expression, meaning they can develop tolerance to alcohol,
sure.
Then you can tolerate more of that toxin. So that's gene expression. Just because you have the genes, it doesn't really mean anything. It just means you can defend against this alcohol.
So that means
now, in fact,
you would need to know all the different gene expression potential, all the all the RNA combinations. Like, you need to know all of those.
Exactly.
What are all these old gene expressions?
Exactly. So you would. And so,
in
2003,
mm-hmm.
if I proposed this,
mm-hmm.
people would say, that's not going to happen for 100 years. That's
mm-hmm.
science fiction. You cannot do that. You can study one gene at a time.
Yeah.
If you try really hard, you can study four or five genes at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot study all genes at a time. That's
mm-hmm.
impossible, because just the microbes in our body have like 100 million genes,
mm-hmm.
and we have 20,000 genes. And so, It's just an extraordinary diversity. But the technology that came about in 2004, called next generation sequencing, is allowing us to do that. And the simple possible metaphor that I can give to people, but I encourage everyone to read about next gen sequencing, at least go to Wikipedia page, is that we are at least 1 billion times faster at sequencing today than we were in 2004, at least a billion times. But you know, one can make an argument that it's 10 billion or 100 billion, depending on how you calculate it. But it's billions of times more data is produced, and that allows us, in one sample, so let's pick saliva, in saliva we can look at in parallel and quantitatively determine the gene expression level for all microbes and all human cells, all in one test. And like I said, in 2004, that would be literally science fiction. You just cannot do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just to close this topic potentially of gene expression, I want to make sure that people understand that two things. One is, every cell in the human body has the same set of 20 to 23,000 human genes that you inherited from your parents, right? The difference between liver and kidneys and heart and brain has nothing to do with genes. All of those cells have the potential to be any of those tissues. So
right.
at the level of a few human cells, if you sequence DNA, you can say, well, this cell could be any of the organs.
Sure.
But it's the gene expression that determines which organ it's going to be. That's one layer. The next layer, someone has a physical kidney, but 3 months later, they have a dysfunctional kidney. Both of those kidneys, 3 months apart, have the exact same DNA. Nothing happened to DNA. Both of those
sure.
kidneys have the potential to be healthy and unhealthy. What's different is that the unhealthy kidney is no longer expressing the genes that are necessary for the function of kidneys,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it's a sick organ. And the only way you can tell that it's sick is if you sequence RNA. If you sequence DNA, you're going to say, well, this is the same DNA you had 3 months ago. There's nothing different, right? And so that's a very fundamental thing. And then when we go to the microbial side, a typical gut microbiome of a human will roughly encode 3 million genes. So there's a potential for 3 million functions. But the bacteria cannot be wasteful and express all of them at all time, because that costs energy. They will die.
Right.
So they express a very small portion. Under 5% of those genes are actually expressed in order to process the nutrients that we're feeding them via our food.
And does that change on a daily basis or hourly basis? Like, how much is this, how fast are these genes expression changing?
Based on the data we have,
mm-hmm.
the gene expression profile of the gut microbiome
mm-hmm.
stays stable for at least a year.
Oh, wow.
Now,
okay.
If you maintain your diet and your lifestyle, and if you don't take antibiotics. If you take antibiotics, everything is ruined. If you change your diet, and you have to change it in a pretty dramatic way to see a dramatic difference. If you change your diet in a small way, you'll see small differences. But if you go from a Mediterranean diet to a ketogenic diet, which are sort of on the opposite side of the spectrum, you know, high carb, low carb, and carbs are, quite a lot of carbs are processed in the colon by the gut microbiome, you will see quite a dramatic shift in about 3 to 5 days, depending on the person. But in general, I would like the audience to think of the stool as sort of a community of microorganisms that all process your diet in a community sense, meaning that they are all working together, and there's something called cross-feeding that I encourage people to read about, where one microorganism may harvest some of the nutrients you provided them to a certain degree and spit those out, and then another microorganism will keep processing those to harvest additional energy from them. So they're not selfish, they're actually sharing, and they're used to the molecular ingredients that you provide them. So if you have, microorganisms do not have the energetic potential to change their transcriptome rapidly, because it costs a lot of energy to turn on genes and express them and make RNA and make proteins. It's a high metabolic penalty that you're paying. And that means if you're changing your transcriptome, you're going to slow down your growth. And if you slow down your growth in a complex community, you may fall off, right? A person has diarrhea and boom, you're gone, right? So you have to continuously fine tune. And this is a very elegant, very beautiful story of microbial evolution and microbial ecology and microbial physiology in terms of how they respond to environmental stimuli and how they can work together to survive in an environment. And this phenomenon where they actually work together as an organ is beneficial to us because they're also protective. They don't like newcomers. And so they naturally protect us from pathogens because a pathogen wants to take over and take it all. And the community doesn't want that. And so we have a naturally built-in protection from pathogens if we have a healthy microbiome. But of course, well, I mean, one absolutely sort of simplest, most well-known example is that many people have Clostridium difficile colonization, but they don't have a C. diff infection. Once they take antibiotics and you wipe out your microbiome, boom, you can get C. diff infection, which is a life-threatening disease. And so that's a very elegant, very simple example that your microbiome is really protective until you destroy it.
So a lot of these nutrients we take in through food, and some of the, I guess you give recommendations, Biome gives these recommendations of what certain types of nutrients to eat. So these cells and these, you know, bacteria or they are, have these sensors. How do these nutrients make a signal to tell that, you know, this type of gene, turn it on and express this RNA?
I mean, this is getting into like hardcore microbial physiology, but basically bacteria do sense what is present in the environment and they do turn on the genes in order to acquire those nutrients. A simple example I can give you is brewer's yeast, right? A brewer's yeast, if you grow it on just pure glucose in the lab, and then you give it a polysaccharide like barley, it will say, well, there's no more glucose, hey, but there's barley. So it produces enzymes that basically are secreted in the environment. They cleave barley into, I mean, the polysaccharide from barley into glucose. The protein transporters on the outside of the cell import that glucose, and boom, now it has glucose to feed on, right? So microorganisms are adaptable, and they do sense. They are like little chemical sensors. They don't have a brain, they don't have eyes, but they are very good at sensing their environment. And this is why a typical microorganism like a bacterium has 3,000 to 4,000 genes, because they have to be able to sense their environment. And speaking of that sensing, there's a beautiful example where one of the ways that, so there are many microorganisms that live in our gut, but they can also live in soil. And so how do they know? They don't have eyes. They can't ask a question, hey, am I in soil? They don't, they can't sense that. So they have to chemically sense, are they in the soil or are they in our intestines? So many of them have developed a mechanism where they produce a small molecule that basically is secreted. It pings our intestinal cells and it stimulates serotonin production. So our intestinal cells don't produce serotonin on their own, just very small amounts. But it's the gut microbiome that stimulates serotonin production. And when we produce serotonin, which is beneficial to us for several reasons, in intestines, that serotonin actually tells the bacterium, oh, I'm in someone's intestine. And so it adjusts its behavior and it expresses the genes needed for it to survive better in the intestine. If the serotonin signal does not come back, then the bacterium says, oh, I must be in soil. Let me express the genes that are going to make me let me survive in the soil.
Like E. coli? Like, give me an example of bacteria just for, again, our viewers. Like E. coli? Like, what type of bacteria are we talking about? Like,
no, these are spore-forming bacteria
spore-forming.
Actually, I don't remember if they were... they were identified at the species level.
Okay,
but
that's fine.
It's a teaser that someone can go read. There's a Japanese publication that identified the small molecule, which is a small 40 nucleotide long RNA that does this stimulation. And there's a group out of UCLA from, I believe, Elaine Tsao, that identified that the group of spore-forming bacteria, but they're like a group, I think they're Clostridia, but I'm not 100% sure. But these are the kinds of chemical interactions that occur at the level of thousands of chemicals between the gut microbiome and humans to maintain our health that we have essentially evolved with, that we are today destroying by eating very poor food, by taking antibiotics, by keeping everything sterile, by keeping our cells sterile, by keeping our environment sterile, by not going and playing out in nature and so on.
So this, you mentioned serotonin. I know serotonin is really important for gut health. Especially, IBS and obviously mood issues, and I assume there's probably some connection there with the IBS symptoms.
I know for publications that show serotonin is important in the movement, the bowel movement, and it's very also important in the glucose regulation, and we actually have some internal data for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, serotonin is likely a neurotransmitter in the gut that's communicating via the vagus nerve with the central nervous system.
Right.
I'm not super caught up on that literature, but it's definitely a teaser for the audience to go and explore.
Yeah,
gut health and mental health are so well connected.
Mm-hmm.
You can induce depression in mice just by giving them poop from a depressed person, whereas if you give them poop from a healthy person, they will not become depressed. And so, there's lots of research showing this strong connection.
You did mention you're measuring the RNA expression. Apart from the different types, are you also measuring the amount of RNA expression of each different type?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Always. So our method is natively quantitative.
Yes.
And that's very important because if you look at IBD, for example, there's a very significant difference in gene expression levels.
Mm-hmm.
In a person when they're in IBD relapse versus IBD remission.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we natively measure gene expression. And in fact, all of our scores that our customers would see are heavily based on the gene expression level.
Mm-hmm.
So the scores like a butyrate score or inflammatory score, any score, most of them, there are scores that are solely based on gene expression levels.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are solely based. And we actually published a preprint on how we do that. So this is sort of a landmark paper. You know, we've kept this sort of a trade secret how we do this, but we decided let's go ahead and publish it. We feel a little more secure as a company, so we published it. So now there's a preprint out there that people can read showing exactly how do we actually build these molecular scores, how do we validate them, and which specific components of the microbial physiology are relevant for that health condition. And so we really sort of open up the box and show people how we do that. And so that's a paper that I hope that many people will read. It's under peer review right now, so hopefully it'll be published soon.
Okay. What about yeast, fungi? Are you also having a look at that? I know a lot of people say that fungal infections are about, could be possible overgrowth of fungus.
So I think, and I'm using the words I think, that fungi are the next frontier in medical fields.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several reasons for that. One is they are, in fact, showing increased rates of acute infections.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for several reasons. They're being spread all over the place. More people are, immune compromised.
Mm-hmm.
And fungi are now growing to be more resistant to antibiotics because those same fungicides are actually used on crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are outbreaks like this. So,
That's
sort of acute infectious side, I've seen the rise of it, but I'm not really an expert in that field.
Okay.
What I think I am an expert in is chronic diseases that are caused by fungal components.
Mm.
And black moles, I think, are causing currently an epidemic of chronic diseases that are completely invisible to the medical community because doctors were not taught about moles. Mm-hmm. There are no good tests for moles. Mm-hmm. There are no solid, there are some tests, but no like widespread and cheap tests for mycotoxins. You have to go to the literature and actually identify all of these studies that have been done on fungi and mycotoxins, mm-hmm. and you have to look at, connect a million dots in order to come up and visit forums and visit, you know, different health groups to get an understanding how big of a problem this likely is. And so I realized that a few years ago. So our bioinformatics team actually worked for a full year to actually comb through fungal genomes and clean them up. One of the biggest problems right now with fungal genomes is that they're contaminated, they're visibly inaccurate. So you cannot really do fungal genomics very easily. Mm-hmm. But we made an effort, and now I believe we have the world's best fungal database. So we can identify all of these different species and strains of fungi that are mycotoxins producers that can easily establish themselves either in the upper respiratory tract or in the gastrointestinal tract. Mm-hmm. They can make biofilms. They're going to be very difficult to treat with fungicides.
Yeah.
And they could be causing problems like cancer, like any kind of autoimmune, like Hashimoto's, possibly multiple sclerosis, possibly. And then Sjogren's and several others. This is all speculative. What is not speculative is that there was a study showing Malassezia fungi as important in the onset of pancreatic cancer. And Malassezia is basically present in everyone's scalp. And there was a study, two solid studies out of Spain that showed that fungi were present in people who just died of ALS, but not in healthy controls.
Oh, wow.
And there are fungi that have been found in the brains of Alzheimer's disease patients, but that's not super solid, so it's still, the jury is still out of that. But it's a hidden world for most, and I think it's an important one. One piece of evidence that we have that is super solid that I cannot wait to publish on when it gets its turn is that we've actually looked at brain fog on a very large population of people, and I think that this sort of axis of Sjogren's, fibromyalgia, brain fog, and then chronic fatigue syndrome. I think they're all either partly or wholly caused by black moles. So we took just brain fog, which is sort of the common ingredient for chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, Sjogren's, and we took two groups of people, those that have brain fog and those that don't, and we found that fungi play a super critical role in those two, and that there's a yin and a yang of fungi. There are fungi that are actually protective, very protective, and there are fungi that are very strongly associated with brain fog. So we just need to find the time to publish that paper, but that's, you know, I take Saccharomyces boulardii probiotic every single day. I do not miss it. And one thing about Saccharomyces boulardii is that when we used to, as monkeys live on trees and smell fruit and eat fruit, it was coating all the fruits. And even as humans, just 200 years ago, you know, we would grow grapes and we would eat grapes and we would smell grapes and peaches and so on. This microorganism coats basically the outside of the fruit. That's what actually brews alcohol, right? But we lost that because now we sterilize everything. We coat it with wax. We gamma irradiate it because we're afraid of listeria. We're afraid of three deaths from Listeria and E. coli, but then we cause this sterile lifestyle where we have no more protective microorganisms actually interacting with us to protect us.
So it could be this is where we wonder about the benefits of our organic foods. This is potentially, there could be benefits because pesticides would probably change the microbiome as a potential.
I mean, that's a very, exactly. So pesticides could, and you know, there's some evidence that glyphosate does disturb the microbiome. You know, the discussion about organic versus non-organic is so complex because it depends on so many factors. You know, it's very possible that in the worst case scenario, someone is growing organic grains and they're just absolutely opposed to spraying. They see that the mold has grown everywhere, you know, Aspergillus has taken over, but they're like, well, this is organic, so they harvest it, and this grain now is absolutely loaded with mycotoxins that are known to be some of the most potent toxins for our physiology, and you're buying organic. On the other hand, maybe pesticides are just loaded in this non-organic wheat and grains, and now you're damaging your microbiome over time. So unfortunately, in today's world, unless you know the farmer and you know their practices and you can physically see the actual food, which is what Whole Foods was, whoever invented Whole Foods and started that company, I mean, those people were visionaries because they realized early on, Whole Foods is the key. That's what we used to eat. We didn't have processed foods until 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if you can see a piece of tomato, you know that it's not moldy. If you can see a piece of grape, you know that it's not moldy. You know that it's not, you know, rotten. It looks good and you're going to eat it. And so really the safest bet is Whole Foods.
When we look at the...
Not Whole Foods grocery store, right. Like Whole Foods. Like, buy your Whole Foods, whether you buy them at
from the
Trader
farm.
Joe's or Whole Foods or your right. farmer's market, wherever. Whole Foods, that's the only one you can trust that it's actually good for you as long as you wash it well, unfortunately. And the best way is to grow it organically in your own garden and just not wash it and not peel it. That's what we've been doing for the last, 10 years. And my gut microbiome is super wild.
You know, there are some other companies out there that people can get their microbiome tested from. And generally they provide like a relative breakdown of the different species of in your gut. But I don't think none of them are doing RNA expression that I'm aware of.
That's correct.
And
yeah.
But I also wonder, are they just looking at relative distribution versus absolute numbers? And I'm wondering if that's something that you're looking at, the company's able to tell you, okay? Because
yeah.
some people may have
yeah.
a relatively small amount of microbiome
yeah.
actual cells.
So
something.
Most gut microbiome tests are performed using 16S sequencing or metagenomics, and those are all relative amounts,
mm-hmm.
so relative to the overall community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not perfect, but that may actually be even more relevant than the absolute amount.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet. No one has done a comparative study.
Mm-hmm.
We hope to do that one day, but it's not clear at this point in time whether relative abundance or absolute amounts are more relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that for some diseases, absolute amounts are better, and for others, relative amounts are better. But we need to develop the technology to actually do that, and measuring absolute amounts is more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
There are specialty tests that are offered by specific providers that will measure absolute amounts. So they will take like a weight, like a gram of stool, and they will plate it out and they will count the microorganisms, or they will do a quantitative PCR. But those tests are always looking for very few specific microorganisms. They don't have this sort of a broad sense. So every technology has some downsides. In 2010, I decided that RNA sequencing has the fewest downsides and has an overwhelming advantage. And that's why I spent 6 years developing that. And that's still true today. Like I said, if a 16S test or a metagenomic test says you have Fecalibacterium presentiae and it's a great butyrate producer, you have lots of butyrate.
Mm-hmm.
That is a false statement.
Mm-hmm.
Just because Fecalibacterium presentiae can produce butyrate,
yeah.
it doesn't mean it's actually doing that in your gut.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no evidence that it's actually performing that metabolic task because it could just have DNA for it, but
mm-hmm.
it doesn't actually perform that. Until you know and you have measured that bacterium is actually performing that metabolic task, you cannot state that. And so that's basically the fundamental problem with all of these, that they detect 3 million microbial genes in your gut microbiome, and they're saying all of them are active. No, they're not all active. We have data that we're going to publish soon, and pretty much everyone knows that not all of them are active. And so you really have to focus on which genes are active, and just as importantly, what level of activity they have, because how much butyrate your bacteria produce is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am, I think there's a very limited opportunity to make accurate recommendations for most things based on DNA-based assays, because DNA is just the potential.
Mm-hmm.
RNA is the actual behavior of any ecological system.
I get a sense that this could operate on many different things, not just the gut. I mean, the RNA expression could be very valuable for
exactly.
the body in general.
I mean, so that's exactly right. So when I started writing proposals in 2010 as a scientist, I not only pitched this to the government agencies as gut microbiome, because national labs, to be honest, were not very interested or knowledgeable about microbiome at that time, but they were interested in pathogens and post-pathogen interactions and soils and so on. So I actually sold this in my grant proposals as planetary health, because the exact same technology can be applied to every single ecosystem on planet Earth. There is no exception.
Mm-hmm.
As long as there are live live organisms in an ecosystem, this, to my knowledge, is the best way to study it. And in fact, the first paper that my group published was actually on soils. It was on soil microbiome. Mm-hmm. The second paper we published was on host pathogen interactions. How do pathogens gain access to human cells? Mm-hmm. And then we moved into toxicology and cancer biology and all kinds of other things. But yes, the technology is useful for many other things. The thing is that when we spun out Viome, we decided to focus on human health, because if you have a sick population, the downstream negative effects are so profound that that is the biggest problem to solve. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to say that, you know, healthy people may have many wishes and desires and dreams, but sick people only have one.
Yeah, sure, sure. Right, makes sense. Yeah. But you decide to obviously focus on microbiome because there's so much more, you know, RNA expression from, you know, bacteria, that like 10 times the amount of human gene expression. Is that correct? Something like that?
No. Let's just clarify this. No, I'm a systems biologist. Mm. I don't subscribe to the idea that microbiome is the root cause of everything.
Mm.
It's a piece of the puzzle. Nutrition is a piece of the puzzle. Sun exposure is a piece of the puzzle.
Mm.
Your environment in many other aspects is a piece of the puzzle. Your exercise, fasting, sleep are all a piece of the puzzle. Gut microbiome plays a very important piece of that puzzle. Your immune system plays a very important piece, and how it interacts specifically with your microbiome, those are very important parts, not just individually, but how they interact with each other. And then your genetics plays a small role as well. And then multiple microbiomes, oral and stool microbiome, gut microbiome for all people, and vaginal microbiome for women, especially in pregnancy. And so everyone should think of the human body as that airliner. Just because the engines work does not mean the plane will take off and fly. You have to have all of these systems that all work in harmony in order for the plane to fly. If one system doesn't work, the plane doesn't fly. And that's exactly how we should think about. And if you just study one system, then you're only getting a small portion of the picture. So saying that any one of these components is the most important, I think is false. They're all important to different degrees in different diseases, but they're all important. And if you don't study them all, you will miss on a lot of factors that are very important for human health.
And so for our viewers, I actually just signed up for the Full Body Essentials Plus, but so what can people do? They basically can go and sign up and get their stool, oral, and blood samples taken and then analyzed. Is that correct?
Yeah, so if you go to viome.com, viome.com,
mm-hmm.
You can find all the products and services we offer today.
Yeah.
The flagship product would be the full body intelligence test, which is stool, blood, and saliva.
Yeah.
And then the customer receives all kinds of scores that are relevant to our health. And then the customer will receive very personalized dietary recommendations and supplement recommendations. And they can then take it from there and follow that diet and buy those supplements. For convenience and for cost effectiveness, you can actually order those supplements from Viome, and we'll make them custom for you, meaning you don't have to go and find 25 different supplements and read all the labels and find out that you cannot get one of them alone. You have to pack it, you know, they've packaged the three others and so on. We actually have a manufacturing facility that will not only provide just the supplements you need, but in the amounts that you need. So that's a nice option to have. But supplements are supplementary. You have to follow diet. If you go eat really bad food all the time, you can take all the supplements in the world, it's not going to keep you healthy. So you really have to follow the diet to the best of your ability, and then take your supplements, and then, hey, watch what happens. And, if you have any kind of symptoms, watch how they go and fine-tune. And you can do a supplementary test, which I've been doing for my family, which is a food sensitivity test that I highly like. And the one I like the most is from Everly Well. So I recommend people do the 96 Well, Everly Well test. Food sensitivity.
How do you spell that? Everly? Everly Well.
Everly Well is a company that offers this test. It's actually, it basically measures the component of the immune system that our test does not measure, which is specific antibodies.
The IgG,
right?
I think it's IgG.
So this test measures all four subclasses of IgGs. If you have IgG for egg yolk, you should definitely stop eating egg yolk for 3 months and see if that makes a difference. You know, in our data, for example, what we do show is that you have, let's say, a plant virus that infects, let's say, bell peppers. if we say to avoid bell peppers, you have to avoid bell peppers. You can't just say, well, I like bell peppers, I'm just going to wing it and do it.
Because this is very interesting, because, you know, I do this test on my patients here and there, and sometimes we get very funny results, like, or like it's so many different things, and it's like, okay, how can I possibly go without these foods? So are you saying that after a few months of maybe avoiding it, your body's reaction might be gone, or this might be a permanent issue?
Well, it depends. It always depends. It may or may not, but I'm saying, unless you give it a good shot, meaning be strict for 3 months. You know, when I changed my diet, I would absolutely not put a piece of food in my mouth unless I was 100% sure that it didn't have any mammalian products. Mm-hmm. If there was a 0.00001 chance that it had mammalian product, I went hungry and I skipped dinner. If I went to a restaurant and they couldn't guarantee that there was no mammalian products, I ate no food, I just chatted with my friends, and I was very happy. But I wanted to test, is this really what's causing my problem? And the only way to find out is to actually do it. Saying, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, on Fridays, I can just eat whatever I want. No, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. So sure. don't trick yourself mm-hmm. into thinking, you know, you can have cheat days. If you really want to find out what's causing something, get rid of it 100% clean for some number of months. I would say 3 months is safe. If it's really painful, like, I don't know, if it's wheat and you just cannot live without wheat, then try it for a month and see how you feel. But a minimum of 1 month. You see, I became vegan back, you know, many, many years ago as one of the diets. But at that time, veganism was just eat salads. And after 2 weeks, I was weak. I couldn't exercise. I couldn't, like, function mentally. I was just exhausted all the time. And after 2 weeks, I gave up. If I had had better vegan food and I had stuck with it for just a bit over a month, I would have said, wow, this is actually helping me, let me keep going. But I didn't last long enough and I gave up on it. Mm-hmm. And so the following few years, I was in pain 24 hours a day just because of that missed opportunity.
And this we call precision nutrition or precision medicine, in effect what Viome is providing you.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you think something could be bad for you, just avoid it mm-hmm. and find out. And once you realize, hey, I'm feeling better, my joints are smoother, or my tummy problems are gone, or whatever, start adding carefully, mm-hmm. one at a time, the most important foods that you're upset about, you know, like coffee. People get so upset about coffee. Add it in, see if you get your acid reflux back. If you do, well, boom, you now know what's causing it, so don't drink coffee. Mm-hmm. It's a little more complicated than that, for example, because a lot of coffees will not cause acid reflux, only specific ones or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so it's very challenging to do this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is very helpful. I think we could go on for a long time, but unfortunately we've got to end. So, but I thank you so much for your time and I really appreciate it. I will put in the notes for people where they can go and order a Viome test. I myself just did it today and I'll look forward to seeing those results and you know, chatting with you potentially after that. Thank you so
much. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you so much. Hi, Dr. Goyal here. I hope you enjoyed today's talk with Dr. Vujicic from Viome, and it was quite amazing, as I mentioned it earlier. Please like the channel, subscribe, send us your comments, and look in the notes for the link to get your own Viome subscription. I myself got my full body essential package done today, so I'll keep you updated on how that's going, but I'm pretty excited about this, and I think this is by far the best microbiome test on the market.